You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of April 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's show...
The secession authorities is saved from a total collapse. It's still there, but is in great danger. It's still alive, but barely.
As dozens are killed at a hospital in Syria's second city, Aleppo, we'll ask if the country's fragile ceasefire is on the brink of collapse. And...
The legacy of the Obama-Clinton interventions will be weakness, confusion, and disarray.
What could US foreign policy look like under President Trump? Also on the program... Dancers are on strike, the artistic director has resigned, and it's even claimed a ministerial scalp. We'll look at the row engulfing Romania's national opera. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Hey, warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, who's a columnist at The Independent and The Guardian, and Tim Marshall, who's the editor of thewhatandthewhy.com and used to be a diplomatic editor at Sky News. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us here in Studio One, as always. We begin in Syria.
The secession authorities is saved from a total collapse. It's still there, but is in great danger. It's still alive, but barely.
The United Nations envoy to Syria, Staffan de Mistura, issuing a dire warning that the country's fragile ceasefire is on life support, fighting for life. The situation there now appears ever more bleak. Shortly after he spoke, a hospital in Aleppo was hit by an airstrike, killing dozens and injuring many more. Mary, perhaps we'll start with you. We talk about a brittle ceasefire, the fragility of it. Does it still exist in any meaningful shape or form? Staffan de Mistura suggests that it just clings on. But when a hospital's being hit, dozens dying, can it be said to be true?
Well, I think he's probably right. I mean, I would trust his judgment. And I think that in a way, you have still just about to have faith. Because if you say, if you simply write it off, and there is the just the vestige of a ceasefire, then I think you're completely writing it off and you're left with absolutely nothing. So I think he's right, and I think that everybody else who tries to persist in the belief that the ceasefire or cessation of hostilities, I think is how it was put at the beginning, is just about possible. Really, they should be given the benefit of the doubt. These sort of things, you know, hospital hits, dozens of people killed at a single time, these things have been happening all the time. And there was, yes, a brief pause after the cessation of hostilities came into force. But ever since then, things have been accelerating. And I think maybe if you stand back for a minute, what you may be seeing in this sort of battle for Aleppo, which seems to be gathering, is in a way the battle for Syria. Mm-hmm. And that everybody is trying to maximise their position with a view to the end game. So I think maybe what we're looking at is not quite as hopeless as maybe it looks.
Tim, do you share Mary's view there? That in a way, that little kernel of hope to cling on to is, you know, the semantic argument's not important. It's important that people retain that hope more than anything.
I agree with every single word that Mary said until the very end, because I don't think there is any hope for this ceasefire. And it's precisely because of what she said just before that, which was that now the battle for Aleppo, which is becoming the battle for Syria, is looming. And so there is no way, now that people have fought themselves into positions where they think they can take back Aleppo, which is what the government's position is, that they are going to sit round the table and stand by what was always, as I understood it from people involved in the peace negotiations, they knew that they would probably fail, but what they wanted to do was create the space to get the humanitarian aid in, and thank God they did. I mean, it's terrible, it's awful, but they did get a lot of the humanitarian aid in. I've argued on this program several times that I cannot see this going any other way than the Bosnian template. You have negotiations, they fail. You have a peace conference, it fails. And you have to go through those terrible steps to get to the end piece. This is not it, but Mary is absolutely right. It is Stefan de Mistura's job to say we need to keep this alive and to cling on to the little things. For example, the Syrian opposition did pull its negotiators out, but it kept what it called a technical team in Geneva. Mm. That is a little signal that, okay, we've got some people there hanging on by the fingernails. And yeah, I hope they do bring it back and put it forward. But I think we're not going to see that happen this side of the fight for Aleppo.
Mary, what's the role, or what should be the role at this stage, given these various pressures that are playing out from some of the other external parties? We think of the United States and Russia, of course. What role should they be playing usefully, given the situation on the ground?
Well, I noticed today, and it reminded me so much of what was being said about Ukraine when that conflict was at its height. It is said that Russia and America have to get together and they have to agree and they have to bang heads. And the problem, of course, is that even with the best will in the world, they cannot actually force people to get together who refuse to get together, who are still fighting. Or if they do, one or the other is going to be accused of using excessive force, because that's the only way to do it. And of course, what will generally happen is that Russia will be accused of using excessive force because it may be prepared to do what the Americans are not prepared to do. But the fact is that those two outside players, however powerful they are, without some sort of will on the ground, it is not going to happen.
Tony, it's interesting, if we look at the US and Russia, you've got a relationship that's antagonistic, I think is one of the only polite ways you could describe it, between, say, Obama and Putin. Do their characteristics shape this discussion, particularly given Obama obviously doesn't have that much longer left in office, and Putin, perhaps we're going to come on to Trump later in the program, but he's sort of, Putin and the Russians generally sort of receiving him fairly warmly, as is perhaps understandable in circumstances. If that relationship is so troubled, does that hinder this process?
It hinders it, but it's not the fundamentals. If the fundamentals were right, the Russia and America could get together and agree a policy, even if Putin and Obama loathe each other, which they appear to do. But it doesn't help, but the fundamentals are not affected by it. And the fundamentals are that although the Americans have been forced by the Russians to shift position, and instead of saying Assad has to go now, have said, okay, well, maybe there's a transitory role. The Russians have forced the Americans to move, but they're still saying you got to sit down and discuss straight away political transition, which is code for Assad going. And the FCO, the British Foreign Office, put out a statement today saying this is only going to succeed if both sides are prepared to discuss political transition, code you've got to discuss Assad going. As long as you keep that on the table, Assad's not going anywhere and he's not going to discuss anything.
Where's Assad at now at the moment, Mary? I mean, it's interesting. We've obviously touch upon the story every now and again, and we talk about the willingness or otherwise of the various factions to entertain different political outcomes, which is often, as Tim alludes to there, code for Assad going. Is his grip as strong as ever? It's clearly not vice-like. The country's so fragmented. But is his grip on what remains of his power base still steady?
Well, I think it depends far more on him and the forces at his disposal than it does on the Russians. And I'm not sure that Assad actually appreciates that, because I think outside the country and generally in the West, we have exaggerated the extent to which the Russians are prepared to underwrite Assad. Every time I've seen contact between Assad and the Russians, it's been Assad the supplicant, and he's tried to take more and more than the Russians are prepared to give him. The Russian priority, I believe, and I believe this from the beginning, is to keep Syria together as a unitary state. And the way they see it at the moment is that the only person, the only regime capable of doing that in the short term is Assad. There is no alternative. But it seems to me that they're entirely open to a transition. That's the first thing. The second thing is that they are also entirely prepared to cut Assad off completely.
Yes. They'll throw him under the bus immediately. If they can find another leader they think, A, can keep it together, and then whatever emerges from it allows them to have their port and possibly an airport as well. Fine, Assad, you've got to go into exile now. It's either Moscow or Tehran, because those are two countries, Iran and Russia, that are not signatories to the Hague Convention, and therefore he wouldn't be extradited. I mean, the plan is there, but there's nobody there, so they're hanging on to Assad, and I'm afraid we are still a long way from peace.
Well, absolutely. And Tim, just to pick up, you mentioned earlier that this could follow a model, you know, such as we saw in Bosnia, where it's kind of trial and error, and eventually you move forwards. Is it plausible that that could happen if Russia retains that viewpoint? And is it plausible that somebody could emerge that unifying figure?
There are several characters. There's a few of them in exile. One fancies his chances who lives in London. There's another guy in Paris who fancies his chances. The people are there. The plan is there. The fighting hasn't stopped. But as long as you still think I can win this, then you keep going. And in Bosnia, it took the Americans basically coming in and slapping their Europeans and saying, get your act together. And they finally bombed the Bosnian Serbs, and that bombed them to the peace table. Now, the Americans are putting an extra 250 special forces into Syria, but that's not going to turn the entire tide. And they're only up against ISIS anyway. So the point I'm making is that there is still more fighting to be done until they're either exhausted or they realise, you know what, I can't win. But I think the genius of the Russian intervention is that they've made sensible people realise that Assad can't lose. And it's we're going to have to go through an awful lot of bloodshed before the people opposing him get that as well. If he can't lose, we can't win. And when that is internalised, we'll see a peace conference.
Let's move on. Is Europe being seduced by nationalist politics? A far-right Austrian politician, Norbert Hofer, came top in the first round of the country's presidential elections this past week. His success follows on the heels of various recent electoral surges for the Front National in France, the Finns Party, pretty obvious where they're from, the People's Party in Denmark. A nice, easy question for you, Mary. What's behind the success of these groups, some as undesirable as they may well be?
Well, I think there's an immediate cause and there's a long-term cause. And the immediate cause is refugees, migrants and apparently uncontrolled borders, with people being able to get into Europe by their hundreds and thousands. And I think that's been the direct cause. It was initially the direct cause in Hungary. Now we see Austria, which also, you know, we have seen pictures of crowds and crowds of people getting into Austria from Hungary and from Slovenia, and Austria decided that it couldn't cope and it shut its borders. And it did that because the thinking behind the Schengen Agreement, that external borders should be secure, which would allow internal borders to be erased, failed over the last year. So that's the immediate cause. The secondary cause, I think you would go a long way back and you would look at Central Europe and origins of far-right parties and sympathies in Central Europe going back a very long way. And then you might move to the Western part of Europe and you would talk about backlashes against globalization, against bringing down borders, against in favor of national identity and the power of the state. And I think all those things go into the mix. But in Austria, the immediate cause of the far-right success has been the refugee crisis.
Tim, is this part, not just the reshaping that's happening because of the impact of the migrant crisis, but is there a reshaping of Europe's political landscape that's happening here? More broadly?
Well, it's being reshaped in several ways. I think it's wrong to think of Fortress Europe, and it's right to think of Fortress Nation State within what they're trying to do as a Fortress Europe. That's one way it's being reshaped. The borders are going back up, and they're being very clearly defined, and the people never forgot where those borders were. It was just the ideologues at the very top that had this idea of a borderless Europe, but the people never bought into that. They're still as what they were before. The second thing that is happening in the political reshaping is that the resurgence of the right, which was obviously predictable once, as soon as you saw that the refugees and the migrants were coming, it's pretty obvious. You only have to have a cursory look at history to see that people will turn to the right. It follows, as people turn to the right, that politicians, being who they are, will tack to the right as well. And they are tacking to the right, left, right, and centre. They're tacking to the right. And so if the Freedom Party are leading in Austria, you will find the response from the centre, which it didn't even get through to the second round, and that's come today with these new laws. These new laws, the Interior Minister's forced them through, Wolfgang Sobotka, allows a state of emergency to be declared in Austria if migrant numbers cause a national security. I mean, that's unthinkable 20 years ago. It's like something from the 1930s. If migrant numbers become a national security issue, we can have a state of emergency. But that's what I mean about the centre is tacking to the right in response to the surge in support for the right wing. And it's going to affect all of us.
But can you go that far? In response merely to a recent crisis, or does it necessarily tap into something that's more ingrained, more fundamental? Because the centre can tack a little to the right, but as you mentioned, that reads like legislation from 80 years ago, and I wonder whether a mere tack to the right could be the driver. Mary, what do you think?
Well, I think that one of the interesting things that's happened in Austria and may well happen other places too is that what we're looking at is a second round of a presidential election where, for the first time, none of the major parties will be represented. So we're looking at essentially two alternative parties contesting the presidency, and the centre-right and the centre-left being absent. And even if that's a very temporary phenomenon, it's a refashioning of the political order that's existed for quite a long time. And I think it's quite significant, and we could see it elsewhere. As far as tacking to the right, I mean, yes, I think when you're talking about states of emergency and putting up the borders and sending people away, yes, this has horrible echoes of 50, 70 years ago. But I may be slightly more sympathetic than Tim is to the idea that the Geneva Conventions and the international protocols on refugees and refugee status are actually completely out of date and completely unworkable in today's world. That where you have people who are able to move so quickly, to obtain information so quickly, where you have essentially provisions that say if you believe your life is in danger and you can convince other people that it is, and that would apply to practically everybody living in a war zone, then your whole asylum system, I think, is completely unworkable.
Speaking about unworkable, I mean, I wonder, Tim, whether the question's not about, you know, shifts to the right or shifts to populist movements. Is it about a recalibration, to pick up on what Mary said, which is more about the established and the non-established parties, or establishment and non-establishment political groups? Are people, is there a question to be asked about people's frustrations maybe at the established political realm, be it left or right, and that they're looking for alternatives now?
Yeah, as we're about to go on to Mr. Trump. But no, I disagree with you. I think people are tacking to the right in response to a resurgence of right-wing nationalistic feeling, which does have indeed very deep roots. And the crash of 2008 meant that Europe has run out of money and can't deal with the current economic crisis. All these things are linked, but it's pretty straightforward to me. I get Mary's point about some of the laws are out of date. You know, it's a bit like the UN and the world order was, you know, designed in 1945, and the world has changed. And the Geneva Conventions and the asylum laws were designed around the same time, and things have changed. But I don't see that what I regard as quite an extreme measure of allowing a state of emergency, which is normally something you have, well, what the French introduced, for example, after the Paris attacks. They've now got it on the statute books that if there's a migrant numbers or a surge, I find that attack to the right. I think it's a surge to the right, and I don't see that within the framework of what Mary was arguing about having to look again at the structure. I agree with that bit, though. We do need to look at the structures.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Tim Marshall and Mary Dajewski are alongside me. Still to come on today's programme. Dancers on strike, the artistic director has walked out and a culture minister's resigned. What on earth is going on at Romania's National Opera? We'll reveal all in a few minutes' time. But first, this.
Whether you're thinking of founding your own nation or would like to make the one you live in a bit better, we have the book for you. The brand new How to Make a Nation, A Monocle Guide, is an informed and quietly provocative book about updating the art of statecraft. After 10 years of meeting inspiring citizens and on-it PMs, soft power influencers and smart architects, we'll tell you how to construct the perfect embassy, design a modern parliament, and even how to make the most of your national dress. This 340-page large format book delivers fresh thinking and lots of solutions too. It's a book about the small things that can make our nations work better for everyone that calls them home. Buy your copy today at monocle.com and all good bookstores. Go on, be the leader.
You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, Donald Trump's been providing a rather fascinating insight into what US foreign policy could look like if, heaven forbid, he were to become president. Let's have a listen.
Unfortunately, after the Cold War, our foreign policy veered badly off course. We failed to develop a new vision for a new time. In fact, as time went on, our foreign policy began to make less and less sense. Logic was replaced with foolishness and arrogance, which led to one foreign policy disaster after another.
The Republican frontrunner said interventions by President Obama had weakened the standing of the United States and sown confusion both at home and abroad. Trump also declared he'd be a much more flexible commander-in-chief and would put America's interests at the heart of his decision-making. Still with me, Tim Marshall and Mary Dajewski. Mary, is Donald Trump the man to strengthen the standing of the United States overseas?
Well, I think it's quite dangerous to be too dismissive of him. There was this poll today that said that sort of every member bar one of the G20 thought that Hillary Clinton was going to be president and approved of that. And I would be very cautious because I think that the result is a long, long way away. And Trump has already, I mean, he's calmed himself down. He's speaking in slightly different terms from the way he was speaking at the beginning. And there was a very, very interesting short letter in the Financial Times about a month ago from somebody in America who said that they'd been in court when Trump came to testify about something to do with his business interests. And this person said, don't underestimate this man. He turned up in court. He behaved entirely properly. He answered the questions. He had a command of the material. And he was entirely convincing and authoritative. And I think that's a side of Trump, obviously, we haven't seen on the campaign trail and doesn't really fit the American campaign trail. I also fundamentally disagree with Trump's assessment of Obama. I mean, I think that Obama as a foreign policy president has been hugely underestimated. Having said that, I think when he calls for a complete redrawing of everything after the end of the Cold War, in many ways he's right. We wasted pretty much the whole of the 90s, and the result to a large extent is the mess we've got today with Russia.
Tim, what do you make of that? Are there sort of kernels of truth, of wisdom in Donald Trump? And are we continuing to sort of underestimate him or almost even misrepresent what he is?
We have very much underestimated him. I actually think he has a very fine-honed mind. He's also so clever. He can express it in ways that connect to people. On business, I've got quite a lot of, I don't agree with everything he says, but I've got quite a lot of time. The guy knows business, and he wrote this book, Close the Deal or Fix the Deal, no, Art of the Deal, bestseller 30 years ago. think he knows business. But I think what he's doing is he's applying business skills to foreign policy, and I don't see that he's got any foreign policy skills. And what he said was actually quite alarming, and I thought showed a real lack of nuance and understanding of foreign policy. And the best politicians and statesmen and women put the two things together. I don't think he's yet shown he's capable of it. And there's a couple of... Well, one was the usual bluster. He's going to sort out ISIS, OK? He's not going to tell them when. Yeah, OK. As if Mr. Obama has been telling them, phoning them, oh, well, by the way, we're going to attack you. That was just sheer bluster. The real one for me was when he talked about China. We're going to fix the relationship, he said. Well, the relationship between China and the United States is actually not bad at all and has been reasonably well managed by the Obama administration. And then he cut loose on Japan... and started talking about, well, you know, we have to go to their defence, they don't have to go to our defence. The problem with that, and this is where the sophistication comes in, the problem is every time you make Japan and the other people in the Pacific area nervous about your long-term commitment to them, every time you do that, they edge a little bit closer to China. And it's that sort of talk that can break relationships over decades. Whereas what they want is reassurance of the American giant so that they don't get dominated by the Chinese giant. And I'm not sure he has yet got the foreign policy sophistication to pull that one off.
Mary, I wonder, from what you said and also from what Tim was saying, are we looking and finding, you know, not pearls of wisdom, but little, you know, blades of useful analysis in what Trump says, because we're just desperate to find it? I mean, I guess anyone who blusters and blunders their way might strike on something that we broadly agree with, or almost inadvertently. Or are you saying that actually there's maybe more thought has gone into this than we would have credited?
I would put it the other way round, actually, that... in a way, both of us are sort of trying to counter what has become an almost complete consensus that Trump is beyond the pale, unacceptable, and we hope against hope has no chance of becoming president. What we are saying is that, first of all, the campaign is different from being president, and second, that communicating with Americans is probably different from communicating with Europeans, and third, not that it's sort of chance little green blades that we're picking up, but rather that there is something there that we shouldn't dismiss, and we're not taking this out of context.
Finally, on today's programme. All is not well at the Romanian National Opera. The company's artistic director has resigned. Dancers aren't dancing, so shows have been cancelled, and even the country's culture minister has had enough. But why? Tim, I know you're desperate to weigh in on this.
Can I just say that I don't care about this story, but... sorry, is this microphone on? Oops, sorry about that. But I would like to thank you for reminding me of that the best cartoon that Warner Brothers ever came out with, which is the Bugs Bunny cartoon based on Tannhauser, based on the Wagner opera, in which the immortal words, "Kill the Wabbit," are sung over and over again. And I haven't got much more to add than that, other than I would refer you to the dancers saying that they want, as part of solving this, to look at the finances of the opera company over the last 3 years. Somewhere in that sentence, I think, is the truth of behind the row.
What a cynic you are, Tim. Mary, on a kind of semi-serious note, though, you know, we talk a lot about soft power. We've got our New Nations book here at Monocle. It's a bit of a theme that we look at. And, you know, in many of these countries, particularly in Europe, opera is very important. It's a historic artistic outlet. It's a national symbol. We should pay attention. Yes. These things are important, aren't they?
This is something I was going to say, that Central Europe especially, but, I mean, across the continent generally, opera is much more of a sort of national institution that is sort of revered than maybe it is in Britain. So I think it's worth looking at that. And also, you know, in some ways, it's been, you know, redoing your opera house is somehow synonymous with the sort of revival of the state. And you've seen that across all of New Europe. But I'd also add something else. There is something about opera and opera houses that seems to generate these sort of conflicts. I mean, you have only to
That's
look...
because they're lovies.
Yeah, I mean, La Scala in Milan seems to be perpetually in some sort of upheaval. And even here, you know, in staid old Britain, in London, there have been the various sort of upheavals at the Royal Opera. But most recently, the Colosseum, the English National Opera, seems to have been in uproar practically every month of the last year.
I'm sensing a Midori House opera special. Tim, you'll be my first invitee that day.
Killer Wabbit.
That's all we have time for. On today's programme, Tim Marshall and Mary Dajewski, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Rhys James, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ilse Viveros. Keeping us on air, our studio manager Chris Chilvers. More music next, then at 1900, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And we'll have more on the day's big stories. We've discussed several of them. The Monocle Daily, 2200 London time. Andrew Muller in the chair today. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London, as if you needed reminding. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much indeed for tuning in. Goodbye.